From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, Hulu makes a bet on stars and food. Then in the stage play, The Niceties, a black student and her white professor have a conversation about race that most people try to avoid.
What's wonderful about theater is that you don't have to talk. You're not under attack. The characters sort of stick up for you. The characters take punches for you. And so you can finally sort of see the shape of how it's all working.
And Johnny Pierce says his band's new album helped heal wounds from growing up gay in a homophobic family. All that coming up on The Frame. Hulu made some news today at the New Fronts in New York City. Those are the digital versions of the Upfronts, the annual event where the legacy TV networks try to sell commercials with their new programming lineups. It's a time when advertisers and the general public get to see what's coming for viewers, and the New Fronts are very important for streaming sites like Hulu that carry advertising. For more on what's been announced, we called up Lucas Shaw. He covers entertainment and media for Bloomberg. He's at the New Fronts today, so we reached him from the streets of Manhattan, and he laid out what Hulu was pitching to advertisers in its presentation this morning.
They were pitching really a star-studded cast, probably the best that Hulu has had thus far. That includes a TV remake of the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral that Mindy Kaling is producing, and one of the main stars is Natalie Emanuel, who's on Game of Thrones, a show that George Clooney is involved in, which is Catch-22, based on the very famous novel. And then they renewed shows like 10-15, which is a kind of a comedy about a couple of women in their 30s, but they essentially are still in middle school, acting as middle schoolers, but you can tell by looking at them that they are, in fact, fully grown adults.
They also announced a new partnership with Vox Media, which owns the food site Eater. And Chrissy Teigen, her production company, is working to create a whole slate of food shows. What's the plan there?
You know, food has worked on TV for almost as long as there's been TV, whether it's the Food Network or Top Chef on Bravo. It's been very successful for Netflix with shows like Chef's Table and Nailed It. And so Hulu, which had just got nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary, is deciding food and unscripted programming is a new place for them to play. They didn't share a ton about what they have planned. There's one show that Chrissy Teigen is going to co-host with Dave Chang, who's the chef behind the Momofuku restaurant. And then Eater, which is the popular food website, is producing a documentary series that's something like The World According to Eater or something like that.
Hulu is now majority owned by Disney as part of its acquisition of 21st Century Fox. So what are they doing in terms of what they're doing on Hulu? Because Disney is also about to launch its own streaming service. How are these going to be different?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. It's one that, frankly, I have asked a lot of people at Disney to try to understand. And I think the simplest way of thinking about it is that Disney Plus, which is the other Disney service, is the home for, of all things, kids. So Pixar movies, they put a lot of the Marvel and Star Wars into that category. But there are types of programs that fit better for Hulu, which is a little more adult, a little more risque. So they announced a couple of Marvel shows today. And then there are those that are right in between. You know, The Simpsons they announced as being part of Disney Plus. I could see that go either way.
Hulu is obviously not the only streaming service that's doing original content. Netflix is certainly doing its share. Amazon is. YouTube is. There's a Walmart streaming site called Vudu. How are these channels and streaming services trying to separate themselves from one another? And is it definable what each one's kind of overall programming philosophy might be at this point?
The way to think about Netflix is that Netflix is just about everything. Other than live sports and news, Netflix is trying to replace just about all you could find in the cable bundle. It's your CBS, it's your NBC, FX, Fox, all these different networks. Amazon and Hulu are sort of in between. They're not quite as comprehensive as Netflix, but they're starting to trend in that direction. But one key distinction that has started to emerge in streaming is those that have ads and those that don't. So Hulu, of the big subscription video on demand services, is the only one that has ads. Netflix and Amazon do not have ads. And so that's one of the big demarcators that we've seen.
But is that model potentially ripe for being overturned? That yes, there is a benefit to having something free, and that is you don't have to pay for it. But the penalty is you have to sit through a lot of ads. And so many people are trying to remove ads from their experiences of consuming entertainment. So is there a model that might be overturned pretty soon? Because Netflix seems to be doing pretty good in terms of growth of subscribers by charging.
I think it's hard to see a world in which there are no online video services with ads. Because one, advertisers need a place to put their money, and video is a really good place for it. But there's just a limit to how many services people are going to pay for. For example, Vudu, which you mentioned, has no subscription. It is only advertising.
And what is Walmart doing content-wise? I would assume it would be something like, here's how to build your own kitty litter box and make your own kitty litter.
Very close. You are going to see a lot of that kind of what they're deeming shoppable content. So you're watching a show, and Walmart knows that you like to buy kind of your new pack of Coke on Fridays every week. And so if you're watching something on a Friday and you haven't ordered your Coke yet, you're probably going to be able to click on a can of Coke in a show that you're watching and buy it. Now, that technology is still relatively unproven, but that's one of the big targets for them and one of the reasons they're doing it. Walmart is funding entertainment in part because it just wants more people coming to Walmart properties and then buying more things from Walmart.
Let me ask you this last question. The new fronts are adjacent to the upfronts, and that's where the traditional networks like CBS and NBC and Fox sell advertisers on their upcoming shows. Does it feel as if the new fronts are not really competing among the streaming services, but with the networks now?
Especially with Hulu, I would say that's the case. They sell a lot of the big ads up front, which the whole point of this event is that a traditional TV network, you know, they sell 70 or 80% of their inventory, especially for the fall, ahead of time by creating that demand and that scarcity helps facilitate sales. So in a very macro sense, yes, they're competing for the same pool of advertising money, and more money is going into the digital world, whereas the money going for TV is pretty static right now. But in terms of the very kind of the simple way that the transactions happen, a lot of those digital buys happen at a later date, which makes the whole concept of a new front kind of strange.
Lucas Shaw is a reporter with Bloomberg, where he covers entertainment and media. He joined us from maybe the only street in Manhattan where they're not honking taxis and fire engines. Lucas, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, the play is called The Niceties. Its conversation about race is anything but genteel. The play The Niceties, now at the Geffen Playhouse, pits a progressive black college student against her liberal white professor in a high-stakes argument over the teaching of American history. The two women find themselves at odds over their own perceptions, identity, and prejudices when it comes to race, justice, and what's taught and overlooked in the classroom. The play was written by Eleanor Burgess. It was inspired by a tumultuous debate over race and freedom of expression at Burgess's alma mater, Yale, in 2015, tied to racially insensitive Halloween costumes. Burgess began by explaining how the Yale campus debate influenced The Niceties.
I was really struck by how much trouble very, very smart, very well-meaning people had talking to each other about this subject. People picked sides very quickly, and because the topic was so personal, they then couldn't really engage with the possibility that another person might think differently from them and have reason to think that. So people sort of either went with, it is really important to be able to put unpopular ideas out there and to be able to sort of push envelopes and that we have to protect academic freedom. Other people were very much on the team of, you know, the only thing that matters here is the experience that students of color are having and are they comfortable on this campus, and the ability to push a controversial idea isn't more important than sort of making sure that students are being able to thrive. And instead of sort of saying, like, both of those things are incredibly important, we have to figure out how to thread that needle together, people sort of picked sides and then could not talk to each other. And that was fascinating to me, this sort of breakdown in understanding and in conversation.
I want to play a clip from the play. We hear the student character, whose name is Zoe, played by Jordan Boatman, and her professor, whose name Janine, who is played by Lisa Barnes.
Because you have no ability to understand the perspectives of your students of color. You have never even tried to imagine our perspectives, and that is traumatic. The constant dismissal of slavery is traumatic. The fact that you don't care is traumatic.
Oh my God, get over it. It didn't happen to you.
And that's a line that gets a big reaction. It didn't happen to you. Tell us a little bit about that line, and it really is a fulcrum in this story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I wanted the play to explore, and one of the things that I think that theater can do, is to explore things that a lot of people probably secretly think or overtly think, but don't really say. And I think that one of the things that makes talking about race in America so difficult is that I would suspect that there are very, very few white people in America who haven't at some point sort of thought, like, well, but slavery isn't now, you know, and some people say it very overtly, like, I'm not responsible for what my ancestors did or for what older Americans did. Can we talk about what's happening now? And for a lot of people of color, of course, that's a complete misunderstanding of how it feels to engage with history, the idea that it didn't happen to you or isn't still happening. And so I think that a lot of what happens in the play is sort of these two women who want to understand each other and want to understand the world, sort of picking at each other and picking at each other until they really do finally say what they actually think.
I'm wondering, as you're writing the play, if you found it easier to write one character over the other, and also if it was difficult to write lines that a lot of people would say, God, I would never say that, but I'm going to have a character say it.
I'd spent, after the Yale incident, 3 or 4 months really not knowing that I was going to write a play about it, sort of reading obsessively about, you know, student blogs about their experiences as students of color and reading sort of professors' op-eds in the New York Times about their experience teaching these days. And I think I had taken in so much of those perspectives, and so much of the reason why I got obsessed before I knew I was going to write a play was that question of, well, how would it feel if I was this person? How would it feel if I were a professor who had built their reputation and their entire life building expertise in a subject to be told that I was wrong? How would it feel being a student today and sort of having all those thoughts so prevalent on my mind as I sat through classes? And so I think that by the time I sat down to write both of these women, I knew them and they were in my head, and a lot of it sort of came pouring out of me. To me, I tend to write less to prove a point and more when I'm genuinely sort of confused and don't know what to think. And so I think the fact I agree with both of them.
So you actually have no rooting interest in who gets to win the argument?
There are certainly parts where I agree more with one than another, and it flips back and forth throughout the play who I personally agree with more. It's really about the audience getting to hear both of them and getting to hear, like, yes, it would feel that way to you if you were this person. And getting to sort of weave for themselves, well, who's right? And I don't have to put my thumb on the scale for either side.
There's also a lot in this play about assumptions. And I want to play a scene from the play. Again, we're going to hear Zoe and her professor, Janine.
This weekend, Sandra Day O'Connor speaking on campus.
Yes, I know. It's very exciting, but it should only take about 2 hours.
Oh, well, I'm part of the Cross Cultural Alliance, and we're organizing a protest.
You're protesting the first female Supreme Court justice?
Yeah, it's a ton of work. We're writing up leaflets on the real effects of her work, and we're going to be live tweeting rebuttals to her speech and staging a walkout. It's a lot to organize.
Are you opposed to there being female Supreme Court justices?
In 41 decisions involving racial minorities, O'Connor voted against the minority all but 2 times.
That can't be right.
That's also one of those things where I think there is such a difference in perspective about the professor saying, well, she's this, she must be great, and the student saying, you know what, just because she has the title doesn't mean that she's done great things.
It's such a difference in perspective, and it's one more area where it's very hard to know who's right. You know, for Janine, a person who has devoted her life to studying history, I think that one thing that happens is if you do devote your life to studying history, I'm a pretty passionate historian or student of history, you do realize that there are no heroes. You know, there's no person who's so perfect that you study them and you don't at some point run into them having done something really terrible, either in their personal life or, you know, getting some issue in a way that we would now consider wrong. So I think for Janine, it would partly be an issue of, well, but you have to study them anyways. You know, you want to go hear her anyways. You want to celebrate what they did that was good. And can we celebrate what someone did that was good if they've also done very terrible things? And I think that for Zoe, that celebrating is erasing the terrible things. You know, you could say that Janine doesn't at all understand how destructive Sandra Day O'Connor's racial legacy was. You could also say that Zoe, having not really lived through the time before second wave feminism, doesn't understand how significant Sandra Day O'Connor's accomplishments were. So there's so much that they each can't see.
And it also seems intentional and important on your part that the white professor is someone we would easily describe as liberal.
Absolutely. I mean, the play is about disagreements between people who theoretically have a lot of the same values and theoretically have a lot of the same goals, you know, and both of them want racism in America to be a thing of the past. Both of them agree that racism is a very real thing in America. And yet they don't agree about what any of that looks like and, you know, how any of it should happen. And I think for me, that's the community that this is set in, is a liberal community. And it's about those fissures.
Let me ask you this last question. What is your pitch to academics to come see this play? Because I can imagine for a lot of them, this is like real life and something that they're dealing with on a daily basis. And watching a play about it might be a little difficult.
Well, I think that it's actually therapeutic to see something on stage because you know, even beyond academia, this is something we're all dealing with. Like, who, yes, I'm sure it's more of a live wire for academics, but who among us hasn't in the last 2 years gotten into a conversation about American history, contemporary American politics, race in America that has gone horribly wrong, where they suddenly find that they're sort of immersed in a thorny disagreement that they didn't even know where it was going to go. We're all trying to figure this out. And it can seem like, oh, God, why would I voluntarily see, you know, a 2-hour conversation about race? I feel like that's my constant. It's in every, you know, newspaper article. It's on Twitter every day. It's a constant thing in my life. But I think what's wonderful about theater is that you don't have to talk. You don't have to think of the next thing to say. You're not under attack. The characters go there for you. The characters sort of stick up for you. The characters take punches for you. And so you can finally sort of see the shape of how it's all working and see how the conversation is going and why it goes wrong and where it goes wrong and finally hear ideas that you've wanted to say but haven't been able to say, said out loud, and you didn't have to say them. So I think that that's sort of what theater can do for people is you see your pain up on stage and your pain is lessened. I think that's how theater works, is that the thing that happens on stage relieves us of a certain burden because we feel less alone and we get to finally feel heard and we get to finally see how the story can go without having to participate ourselves and without having to be sort of vulnerable or at risk ourselves.
Eleanor Burgess is the playwright of The Niceties. It's at the Geffen Playhouse now through May 12th. Eleanor, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Niceties is at the Geffen Playhouse now through May 12th. Coming up, Johnny Pierce from the band The Drums talks about music and personal healing. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Johnny Pierce is the creative force behind the indie band The Drums. Now in his 30s, he's turning his attention away from partying and the other pitfalls of the typical musician's lifestyle. Instead, he's doing a deep dive into the work of personal healing. He spoke with The Frame about how the band's new record, Brutalism, played a role in restoring the one thing that seems most vital to his well-being, interpersonal connection.
You know, I grew up as a gay kid in a small little town. Both of my parents pastored a big Pentecostal church where we prayed in tongues and, you know, I was being put through anti-gay sort of corrective therapy. My father, every night before bed, would sit next to my bed and he had a cassette tape, an ex-gay pastor who now has a wife and kids, and he's giving his testimony of how he's been cured of homosexuality. And so I would lay in bed and my dad would sit there in the chair and make sure I listened to the entire thing before I went to bed. What you You know, I didn't have control over my own life. And I think when I finally left that town and went to New York City, I don't know, it just, I had to work really hard to make it work. It just developed this way of, you know, like if I'm not in control of everything, then everything's going to fall apart. You know, I never had a safety net or something, you know, my life has never been cushiony. I used to just do everything on my own, pretty much. What I did with brutalism is a very different thing, and it took some courage on my part because it went against everything that I typically would do. And, you know, I brought in a guitar player, I brought in a drummer, I had people actually write with me, and that was kind of a scary thing, but voila, suddenly I realize now that, you know, the thing I feared the most turned out to be really the greatest gift. I think the last few years, there's been a lot of soul searching going on. So, you know, I dove into therapy pretty hard, started eating differently. I think ultimately what triggered this heightened sense of, oh my God, I've got to figure myself out, was going through a separation. I was married a few years back and it didn't work out. And Nervous is towards the end of the record, and you know, it made this record, but just by a hair. I wrote that song when I had just gone through my divorce, and it sort of is this detailed account of some moments in the couple days following our decision to officially go our separate ways. So, you know, he had to come by to a place that we both had lived in, and you know, it was the first time that I had ever felt nervous around him. You came over today to a house full of all of our things, and you were holding your coat. You didn't know when to put it down, and you couldn't look me in the eyes. They were darting all around. I actually thought it would just be a song that I would maybe send to him one day, a song that I would just keep for myself. It just felt like the album needed a song like that, so I kind of brought it back from the dead, redid the vocals, changed a couple things, and it's a special song about a very real moment. Being nervous around you, oh, that's something new. In the church that I grew up in, music was going all the time. You know, even when my father was preaching, he'd often just have someone playing piano behind him as sort of an emotional lubricant, I think. You know, there was an old analog synthesizer that he used to use as sort of an organ replacement, and I just asked him if I could have it. And so I took it up to my room. I would start the metronome and hit record. Before I knew it, I was creating these sequenced movements, entire songs. I was falling in love with bands that were making music with synthesizers. And at that time, there was a band called Joy Electric, and he would compose entire records off of, you know, a single monosynth. I was really inspired by that. He actually was on Tooth & Nail Records, which was technically a Christian label, so I was able to listen to him freely for a while, until my dad thought that maybe he might be gay, and so it was influencing me a little bit. So there was a while where I wasn't allowed to listen to that band, yeah. My pretty cloud in the sky. The moments of joy that I do find, it's in moments of connection. You know, I'm just learning now in my 30s, like, how to really connect with people. And then, you know, some days I think I got it. And then the next day, I'll feel like I'm at square one. And I think we have a hard time connecting with each other when we live our lives so guarded. I always say, like, privacy is overrated, you know. I think it kind of stops us from really engaging, you know, and finding the joy in human connection.
That story with Johnny Pierce of The Drums was produced by The Frame's intern, Paul Ratliff. And that's our show for today. You can get our podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Sensitive.